Well, let me get a sense of your attitudes, whether we are on the same political page. I'd like you to raise your hand if the Ryan budget that guts Medicare in order to give a big tax cut to the richest people in the country offends you. I thought I had political kin here. If you're embarrassed to live in the one industrialized, advanced, democratic society where there's a major political party that disagrees with 97% of the top scientists in the area of climate change, please raise your hand. If it seems to you a form of insanity, or worse, that same major political party is trying to undo the modest attempt to institute financial reform in the wake of the biggest financial disaster to hit the United States and the planet since the Great Depression, please raise your hand. Well, not everybody raised their hand, but so that's probably a story, but I'm not in a position to tell it, so it was certainly a great majority of people. If these were normal political times, a candidate would presumably come to a group like this and talk about those kinds of issues one by one. This is what I plan to do, I support this, I'm prepared to do that. But these are not normal political times. It is essential that we realize how abnormal they are. Because I have the conviction that this time in our history, I don't just mean this election, this moment, but this decade, and as far at the moment as the eye can see, we face a crisis as grave as any that has ever faced this country. In some ways, in terms of the battle for the soul of the nation, I believe this is the most dangerous time in our 220 years as a nation. If these were normal political times, I would not be running. I haven't run for anything since student council in the eighth grade. An election which I won.
Bravo.
I wasn't planning to run for anything. If things were being taken care of, I would be happy not to be running for anything. This isn't the life that I had in mind to be living. But the business isn't being taken care of. We have this crisis. And I am running not only because I feel that our nation's future is in serious jeopardy, that we are in fact losing our country month by month, year by year, but because I feel that I understand the crisis and have something to say about it that could have an effect if enough people join with me. Because I see that this crisis consists of a battle. It's a battle that's only being fought in a one-sided way. That's the problem. It's a battle that must be fought in a two-sided way, and the side that isn't fighting, which is our side, needs to win. And this third element, besides feeling that I understand the crisis, and that I have a sense of the battle and the battlefield, I feel that I understand the strategy by which this battle can be fought and won. And it has to be from the ground up, from the grassroots up, because we have seen enough to know that the forces that are at work at the center stage of American politics now are not on their own going to resolve this crisis satisfactorily. We are becoming the kind of nation that we have always abhorred. And the only stopgap that remains is if the American people, or a sufficiently large segment of the American people, take it on as their task to save this country for ourselves, for our children and our grandchildren, or we will become that kind of country. Now, my analysis of the crisis, of the battle that must be fought, and of the strategy are contained in this button, which is, it says, "Let's talk about the elephant in the room." This is my wife, April. If this were in normal times and I were somehow running, I would be here trying to make you like me and be a likable guy. But I'm not going to be trying to do that except to say, check April out. She's such a sweetheart. If she's happy with this guy, he must be all right. But other than that, what I wanted to say is, if you want a button like this after you hear what the whole thing's about, we brought some buttons, and you can have a button. Let's talk about the elephant in the room. A group that has a problem with the elephant in the room has two problems. There's the elephant, and then there's the fact that the group isn't dealing with the elephant. The idea of the elephant in the room, raise your hand if you're familiar with it as an expression in our culture. Okay, good. The elephant, it's a nice sort of coincidence that the elephant is the symbol, not only of the unconfronted problem of that expression, but of the party that is the political wing of a force that has arisen in this country, which I say, as a student of American history, is an unprecedentedly destructive force. We have never seen anything like this at center stage in American politics. It really bothers me that when we watch the news and hear people reacting, we see things on a daily basis that 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago would have been considered an atrocity. And now it's considered normal. If we start losing our ability to recognize what the American way has been and stop being able to perceive when there is a significant deviation, something which is dark and destructive, we are in great trouble. I'm running to try to make sure that we do not fall asleep while the country becomes dark. We have never seen a presidency as lawless as the one that preceded Barack Obama's presidency. I would say that in 220 years, if you make a list of things reasonably to be considered impeachable crimes, the overwhelming majority of them would have been committed between 2001 and 2009. I don't believe there has ever been a time in American history when the opposition party deliberately made making the president fail their overriding priority. And this was at a time of national crisis. But even not being at a time of national crisis, I don't believe any political party in American history has ever behaved that way. If you look at their communications, I don't believe you can ever find a major political party that has had so little allegiance to the value of truthfulness as this one. Lies, distortions, con jobs. I really would challenge anyone to put forward anything which has come from the Republican Party in our times which represents honest political communication. There's nothing new about untruthfulness in politics, but if we can't distinguish between the spin of the salesman and being possessed by the lie, we are in trouble. There's often been in American politics a degree of divisiveness, pitting one group against another group. But this party consistently works to divide Americans against each other. One race against another. Not as much of that as we've had at earlier times in our history. But think about the mosque. Think about the brown-skinned people who they say be afraid of with their anti-immigration scare tactics. I don't think in my lifetime, I'm not sure about all of American history, we've ever had a political party that was so determined to take power from the weak to give to the strong, and money from average people to give to the already fabulously rich. One of the problems in our understanding these days is we look at this event and this event and this event, we don't see the pattern. It's not just a lie. It's not just the birther lie or the death panel lie or the weapons of mass destruction lie or we're running to save Medicare lie. Or, I mean, we could make a long list. It's the pattern of lying. And once you get the pattern of lying and you look at that pattern and you look at the pattern of divisiveness and the pattern of serving the rich and powerful at the expense of the less rich and the less powerful and all these other things, no positive vision for a better future, always bringing out from people their fear and their hatred, never their better selves, never finding issues that allow people to come together on the basis of their shared values to achieve their common purposes. If you look at all these patterns that we have seen for day after day for a decade, then you get an idea that there is something animating this, which is the opposite of what our religions teach, what our founders had in mind for what kind of society we were supposed to be, and what people, at least of my generation, grew up being told, this is what America represents. This is not what America has represented, but it is what we are becoming. That's the elephant in the room. It's not only very ugly, but it is damaging to everything that it touches. If we were to make a list of the things about our country that we have cherish the most, the rule of law, rational discourse, a sense of national community and compassion, whatever the list would be, our economy, a thriving middle class. We contrasted ourselves with countries like Latin America, where you can't have a democracy if you've got a few people with the big plantations and everybody else living in poverty. We have a thriving middle class. We put it together with the GI Bill. If you look at all these things and say, what is the condition of it now compared with 10 years ago? Is there a single dimension that isn't in worse shape? The only way that a force like this can gain power in a society like ours is if it deceives people about its true nature. Nobody will willingly give power to shape their society's destiny to a force that's doing what this force is doing. That a force that is animated by this spirit where fear and hate and division and conflict and the opposite of look after the widows and the orphans. It's the opposite of it. Turn on the most vulnerable. Get elected and say you're going to create jobs. Forget about that. Turn on the people like pregnant women and in difficult situations and older people who may not be able to keep their houses heated and families that need help from food stamps to have something to eat. Turn on those people. We know what that spirit is about. If people saw that clearly, they would never give power to it to shape our destiny. Yet so many of our countrymen do. And so many of the rest don't see it. Why is that? There's where it becomes important to be talking about the elephant in the room. And that's where this other side of the body politic, the other major elements of the body politic, have also failed us. There is the invasion of this destructive force, and then there are the people who are supposed to be the guardians, that our founders set up a system so we could protect ourselves when we're confronted with something like this. They understood that this thing that we're facing was a danger. The whole premise of the Constitution was, let us equip the future generations of America with the means to protect themselves if something like this should arise. If I was talking here 3 years ago, I would be talking about a president that was usurping power, using signing statements to essentially give himself powers denied by the Constitution, giving the single-digit salute to Congress rather than allow them to effect their constitutionally mandated role to oversee that the laws are being upheld. A whole list of things. Usurpations. But now they are not in power, and so we don't have impeachable offenses to deal with. What we've got, however, is the continued destructiveness. The people who ran on country first wanted the president to fail. That should have been a scandal. The people who read the Constitution when they come into office, just recently in this Congress, said in the Senate, you can't pass anything in the Senate without 60 votes. That was a Senate rule they were using. It wasn't even a law. And the Constitution says that the Senate is to be governed by a majority. That's why the Vice President can break a tie. That should have been a scandal. Country first. Constitution. We the people. The hypocrisy. Our founders gave us a system of government with a free press. This is, I believe, one of the major stories in American history. I say that as one who has taught American history. But our media are not covering it. We had wall-to-wall coverage for a year, culminating in the discovery of a blue dress that hadn't been gone to the dry cleaner. How many times more attention did that get than this story that what our founders feared is coming to pass? Back when I was in my mid-20s, and some of you were younger than that and some of you were older than that, we had statesmen of both parties conducting televised hearings about presidential misdeeds that were nothing compared to what we have seen in recent times. And we've seen nothing like that now. Most of the American people have no idea to how much, to use John Dean's book, worse than Watergate, that was. And he wrote that book and used that title before we knew half of what was going on. We didn't know about the torture. America has executed people for things that the people at the very top were guilty of. And we have not been told the story. But even as disturbing as that is, I am coming here to speak the truth as I know it, and I'm not going to spare my political party, our political party, from its share of the responsibility too. This is the gut. We, Democrats, should have been the guardians. And we have shrunk from that confrontation. Our champions, the people that we sent to Washington to be our champions in this, have again and again failed to fight the fight that needs to be fought. And the thing is, The reason why I'm not here just talking about we got to save Medicare, though we do. We got to do something about climate change, though we do. We need to reform the financial system, though we do. And all these other issues that we could talk about. The reason I'm not talking about them is, and we have seen this, unless we confront the basic problem, unless we fight the basic battle, all these other battles go badly. It's like having a table that's been tilted. You can try to push things up, but everything just falls down. You level the table, then you can make progress on all these other things. You can see how it works. The House of Representatives passed over 400 good bills that died in the Senate. And the ones that got through, healthcare reform and financial reform and the stimulus, were all less than they should have been. And all of them were less than they should have been because the battle that needed to be fought didn't get fought. Let me give you a comparison of two different scenarios that shows how different it is if you blow the whistle and call out what's going on versus if you cave. The example of how we can win was shown in Wisconsin. Even though they passed that bill, and I don't know if it's going to stand up because of they cheated on some rules. You know, if it had gone the way things have gone in Washington, this new governor would have put out this thing to essentially violate one of Wisconsin's most sacred political accomplishments, a value that we don't have here in Virginia, but they certainly do from their history in Wisconsin, the collective bargaining rights of their workers. And it just would have passed, and that would have been it. It just would have been it. It would have just been another atrocity of a kind that we could list dozens, but they didn't. They took to the streets. They stopped the game. The Democrats left the state. They stopped the action. The whole country looked, and the people of Wisconsin looked, and they saw what they were doing, and the numbers moved. I think, I don't recall exactly, but I believe that the numbers of approval for the people who had just elected this Republican, Walker, I believe that they moved 20 points. There's a recall movement for the Republican senators, and they're getting geared up to recall Walker as soon as but the important thing is, you talk about the elephant in the room, you make an issue of it, and people see. I mean, it would be nice if all our fellow citizens just saw, because it's right there in front of our eyes, but you deal with the world as it is, and they have to be shown. Most Americans have to be shown. And that's what a political leadership is about. FDR did it, and the people stayed with him, elected him 4 times. He said, "I welcome their hatred." He didn't keep on extending his hand in friendship. He got bitten again and again and again. He said, "All right, you want to fight? Let's fight." And he beat him. You can beat him with the truth. But what happens if you don't even fight? Well, let's go back to December. You got the issue of the Bush tax cuts that were, let's not even go back to 2001 and that disreputable process by which that got passed, and the Republican Fed chairman said, "Oh no, it won't affect the deficit." Well, you know, it added about, what?
14 trillion.
How much?
Well, maybe 10.
In the first 5 years, the tax cut by itself added over $500 billion, and I don't know how much since then. But
they were saying 3 on the television today, over 3
for that.
10 years.
So the American people agreed with the Democrats on this issue. Every family in America, the first $250,000 you make, you keep the tax cut. Then from $250,000 up, like the last dollar that a billionaire earns, let's let it go back to where it was in Clinton's presidency, which was a very prosperous time. It's not exactly crippling. And if you're a billionaire, it's hard to get crippled anyway. The American people were the economics of it. If you're going to do anything to add to the deficit, giving additional money to the very rich is the least helpful to the economy. They had economics going for it. You want to do job creation? Here are things that we can do that would have five times as much benefit for dollar as this Bush tax cut. The Democrats should have run on this issue, but they didn't. But we're talking about December. They'd already lost the election because they didn't talk about the elephant in the room. They had already lost the election because a lot of old people had been sold a lot of lies about Obama's health care reform. That's another story. If you forfeit the battle, you don't win it. And here's a situation where the clock was ticking. The Republicans were holding a gun to the public good, saying, if you don't meet our demands, we're going to hurt America. Because in our fragile recovery, having everybody's taxes go up, which is what they threatened, we won't raise anybody's. We won't keep anybody's tax cut unless you give us all that we ask for. Letting everybody's taxes go up in a fragile recovery like this would hurt America.
They were going to let unemployment benefits expire too.
Yeah. That has 5 or 6 times as much benefit for the economy per dollar. So, unlike in Wisconsin, there wasn't something here's a perfect opportunity to show the American people what this force is about. They're willing to sacrifice 98% of Americans to serve their corporate masters. It's an opportunity. You might pay some price if on January 1st everybody's taxes went up. It wouldn't necessarily be permanent. It wouldn't be a good thing, but you could pay some price. But what's the cost of Americans not understanding what's going on? And what's the cost of enabling the blackmailers and telling them blackmail works? Well, we've seen what the cost is. Round 2, we make cuts that are going to cost 400,000 jobs in order to avoid a government shutdown. A government shutdown also hurts America, but it was another opportunity to show what these people are about. These are not smart cuts. They were cuts aimed at the vulnerable. They weren't cuts aimed at the places where the cuts should be made. And it's not a time to be cutting if you're an economist. And my father is a professional economist. I've written 2 books on economics. It's not a time to be cutting. The time to worry about the deficit is when we get back on our economic feet. The problem with our economy, with our deficit, is we have people out of work. And that because they learned that blackmail worked, they used it again, and 400,000 more people will be out of work. Is not a way to close, to help with the national debt. It is a way to destroy. That's what this force does. And our guys, our champions, folded without allowing the tax cuts to go up, without what happened in Madison, to get the American people to see what's going on. And now we face the third round. Meet our demands or we'll blow the head off the whole American and perhaps world economy by letting America go into default. So that's the elephant in the room. We got this one side. It's not true both sides do it. No, both sides don't do it. It's not like there's a symmetry here. But both sides have defects. This side makes a fight out of everything, even when there's no need for it. And this side shrinks from the fight, even when it's absolutely essential. That's what we've got to change. I'm running as a Democrat because, not because I'm proud of how the Democratic Party has behaved in this time. They've been honorable in their intentions and their purposes and their goals, and they've been telling the truth, but they have shrunk from the battle, and I am ashamed of that. I'm running as a Democrat because I want the Democratic Party to be stronger, and I want the Republican Party to be weakened. With the truth, that is their vulnerability. That is why this is a strategy to change the country, if we can undeceive the people who are deceived and tell our leaders that we want them to talk about the elephant in the room, tell the media, we want them to tell the story about this elephant in the room, because we are losing our country. We have seen that in America there is a fire that can catch on. We saw it in Madison. The people took to the streets. There is an energy there. We who elected Barack Obama saw that there was an energy there, an aspiration to make this country fine again. It's there. The people at the center, the Democratic Party, national leadership, the media, and certainly the Republicans, they're not going to change what's happening. But if enough of us catch fire, answer a call to battle, that's what I wish to issue you here today, as opposed to saying, like me, though I would like to be liked. What I really want from you more than anything is to say, I will enlist in this battle. I love my country enough, I care enough about this, that I'm willing to sacrifice some of my ease to get this thing to happen. If we don't try, we will fail. If we do try, maybe we can succeed. So, I have offered a way of looking at what the crisis is, at the battle that needs to be fought, and the strategy by which it can be won. The next question is motivation. I'll just tell you about me. I've gone through a lot of pain watching this since I first realized what was happening, which is September of 2004. I've lost both my parents, and some of that was very, very difficult. And I've gone through other things in my life where I've suffered, but nothing like, there's nothing that has been as difficult for me as watching this day after day. If I could find a way to have peace of mind and just cultivate my separate garden, maybe I would do that. And if that works for you, I expect that that's what you'll do. But if when you watch the news, you feel as I do, like you can barely stand it sometimes when you know which way things should be going, and it is just so frustrating, and you watch what the Republicans are doing, and you find it just so offensive to your sense of decency and justice and truthfulness. And if when you watch our guys not fight, if you feel that same kind of frustration, and if you listen to the one side that lies with every time they open their mouth and the other side that fails to tell the truth, if you just yearn for truthfulness to emerge into our political dialogue, if you have those passions, then maybe you can harness them, channel them, and bring them into the battle I'm talking about. If you see the stakes as being as serious as they are, the image that I have in my mind is the contrast that we see in It's a Wonderful Life, the Jimmy Stewart movie. Raise your hand if you're familiar with that film. Okay. It's nice that we have some shared things in this country. There's Bedford Falls, where Jimmy Stewart has lived a life of some sacrifice because he's a decent guy and events conspired to prevent him from living the life he had in mind. And then he's about to kill himself because, you know. And the angel shows him. He says, "It'd been better if I hadn't been born." And the angel shows him, "If you hadn't been born, this is how it would be." And you see these families have been ground down. It's not even called Bedford Falls anymore. It's got the name of the greedy, mean old guy who's just interested in his own wealth and power.
It's also a bit, and I
don't think it's plausible, but even Donna Reed has become this mousy person who can't even be greeted on the street. But anyway, you get a certain amount of suspension of disbelief. And he sees the contrast. Well, I believe that we are in a moment, not this very moment, not just this election, but this era of our history. We are facing a choice as stark as that, really. I really believe this. I've spent my life trying to understand the dynamics of civilized systems, and I believe we are facing a choice between becoming the America that we, that Frank Capra movies was about, or at least as much as we used to be that, and an America in which propaganda from the very, very few holds everybody else in its thrall. Truth has basically died. The many are poor. The proportion, you know, we've tripled the proportion of our national wealth in the hands of the very, very top in just the last generation. That can go a lot further. You know, in medieval Europe, 99% of the wealth in the hands of 1% of the people. I mean, there is no limit, history shows, to how bad things can be. So if you look at the stakes, and I'm not trying to be hyperbolistic, if you look at the stakes, that also can affect your motivation. Now, one other step that was important for me to take, and that is, I was born in 1946. I didn't fight in World War II, you can infer that. But my father's generation faced a threat from fascism from abroad. And 16 million men, and however you want to look at the, you know, the whole country, but particularly 16 million men in uniform, had to put their lives on hold. Some of them leaving their lives on battlefields around the world, others leaving limbs, and everybody else coming back, you know, millions coming back with scars that may or may not have ever healed. But at the very least, they had to put their lives on hold. And I told myself a few years ago, if it made sense for those people to sacrifice what they sacrificed to protect the country from the threat that faced them at that time, what does that mean for what I should do with my life in terms of my ease versus answering the call? Now, we're not going to get drafted into this battle. Everybody will be allowed to sit this one out. We can only draft ourselves and encourage others. So if you see the battle as I'm speaking about it, and you feel that you've got the motivation, then the last question is, so what can I do that could make a difference? Well, no single soldier in World War II won the battle. So make a difference means put your shoulder to the wheel. It doesn't necessarily mean single-handedly wipe out, you know, Nazi Germany. That was never a choice for anybody, but for a soldier, it meant if you have an opportunity to strike, you strike. And if you're at all heroic, you look for the opportunities to strike. So what you can do, well, there are two different ways of thinking about this. One is you can help me, because that's what I'm about. That's what I'm dedicated to. That's what I'm going to, and anything you do to help me helps that. And April's going to pass around a sign-up sheet. If you want to be in the loop of communication and vulnerable to the obnoxious things that politicians do when they're running a campaign for public office and facing a 20-year incumbent in Bob Goodlatte, who's got $2 million or $4 million at his hand, beck and command. I don't need that much, but I do need something. And I need help of a lot of kinds. But if for whatever reason you don't want to do it by helping me, that is fine too. And we don't even know for sure if this particular area is going to be part of the 6th district where I'm running. But that doesn't even matter, because this is a national issue. You can talk about the elephant in the room by, you know, you have neighbors that say something, and it's easier to just walk away. Especially since a lot of us have experienced that there's this trance state that's very difficult to penetrate. But if you're a good soldier, you don't necessarily walk away just because it's a little risky feeling. You try to find something that you can say. And I'm going to put on my campaign website, which isn't up now, a forum where people discuss what worked and maybe what didn't work. I walked up the other day at the water cooler at work. Somebody said such and such, and I said to him, this. And it seemed to have, it seemed like he woke up in some way, or it got him thinking. And the people can learn from that. This is a 17-month till next election, but we've got a chance to start educating people. You can write letters to the editors. Put the ideas out in front of people, best of your ability. If you've got a different candidate in whatever district you are than me, you can say, there's a guy over in the 6th district that's got a message. Maybe you could incorporate a bit of that into what you're going around. Not just talk about Medicare, but talk about the underlying values as Americans and what this means, that they're doing what they're trying to do, what they're doing, and why we are different, and why this is the American way, what we are doing, and why this is not the American way. To point a gun at the head of the public good and say, give us our, meet our demands or we'll hurt America. That is not the American way. Bring that into your election. Or you can write to our president and say, we support you for re-election, sir, but we need you to stand and fight. You are our champion. You've got the bully pulpit. It is not okay for senior citizens when we've got the truth on our side and the bully pulpit and a communicator as gifted as you, and we lose the election because 20 million senior citizens believe things, lies, the Republicans said. We should never have lost that messaging battle. We need you to step up. You've thrown the good jab. You throw the good jab, but you got to keep throwing it. You can't just let them recover and come back as strong as ever. And you can write to the networks. And you can say, this is a big story. We need you to tell it. Enough people doing this. I have plans for this. I'm swinging for the fences. I don't know whether I'm going to, how much wood I'm going to get on the ball. But Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote a novel, and it sparked a fire. I've got a message. I'm going to do everything I can to spark a fire in my district, and I've got ideas about how this might go national. And people like you can help me do that. There's all kinds of things we can do. And if we try, we might succeed. Who knew that writing Uncle Tom's Cabin would provide a spark to say, no, freedom is going to be the American way and not slavery. And that is basically the issue that we face as we look to the future. So I ask you to answer the call to battle. This is why I'm running.